Before starting, I would like to apologize for changing the title, so just slightly, from Reason Infallibilism and the Normal Belief to Reason Fallibilism and the Normal Belief, very slight change. And also for changing a bit the content of my talk with respect to what you find in the abstract. Actually, in the abstract, I suggest a positive conclusion to the discussion of a philosophical puzzle. Unfortunately, this is a work in progress, very work in progress, and I discovered recently big problems with the positive suggestion I make in the handout. So the conclusion of my talk will be aporetic. So this is what I will do in the talk. I will first introduce a philosophical puzzle about epistemic reasons. And this puzzle is based on an apparent tension between three claims which have been independently defended by many epistemologists. And then I will consider and critically assess several possible solutions to this puzzle. In particular, I will consider six possible solutions, if I have time. And I argue that all those solutions are affected by some problems. And so then at the end, I will ask you, what do you think about this puzzle, about which I am thinking about by a long time, but every time I find a potential solution, then I find the problems. So this is the puzzle. Consider the following three claims about epistemic reasons. Those claims have been independently defended in the literature. So the first is reason fallibilism. It's the idea that the existence of an epistemic reasons to believe that P does not entail that it is true that P, or the existence of an epistemic reason not to believe that P does not entail that it is false that P. So reasons are fallible. This claim is not about the potential falsity of the fact that constitute a reason, but about the proposition that is supported by the reason relation. So if the fact that P support is a reason to believe proposition Q, Q can be false even if P is a reason. The second claim is the ought reason link, as I call it, which say that what you ought or might find or might do, might believe, might feel, either determines or is determined by what reasons there are for you to find. And in particular here, the determination relation is interpreted by many philosophers in a direct, straightforward way, one in which you can either derive oaths and the permissions from reasons or vice versa. An example, a classical example that you can find in the literature on backpassing accounts is that what you ought to do is nothing but what you have sufficient reasons to do, or what you have outright reasons to do, believe, feel. And the third claim is what I call epistemic non-factivity, which is a very popular idea in contemporary epistemology, which is that the condition required or permitted by the normal belief is a factive condition. So either truth or knowledge, or being in a position to know, interpreted in a factive sense, or some other condition this time. And for example, one ought to believe that P only if P is true. So from those three claims, those three claims seems at least prima facie incompatible, because first assume that the normal belief is factive. Then whether one ought to believe that P depends on whether it is true or P, or whether one ought not to believe P depends on whether it is false or P. This depends on the formulation of the norm. Now from this and the ought reason link, it follows that one has the reason not to believe P, or to believe P if and only if, or only if it is false or it is true with P. Consider, for example, the principle I mentioned before, what you ought to believe depends on the directly depends on the fact that there are sufficient reasons for you to believe P. So you ought to believe P if and only if there are sufficient reasons to believe P. If a norm, the normal belief tell you not to believe falsities, then from this you can straightforwardly derive that there are no sufficient reasons to believe falsities. But this claim is in direct contrast with reason fallibilis. We say that there might be reasons to believe falsities or to believe things that to believe false proposition or not to believe true propositions. So the point is that from altruism link and epistemic norm factivity, we can derive that reasons are infallible. And this is in direct contrast with reason fallibility. So now I will introduce each claim and I will show some reasons why philosophers supported such claims. And then I will present a specific version of this puzzle. So reason fallibilism. This claim is endorsed by the wide majority of epistemologists. The idea that P can stand in a reason relation to belief that Q, even if Q is false. Or that P can stand in a reason, a negative reason relation, a reason not to believe that P, even if P is true. And so this reason, this claim is true, in particular if you assume that epistemic reasons are evidence, as many philosophers admit, and then evidence can be misleading. Here is an example, that the lawn is wet is a reason to believe that it is or it was raining. This is compatible with it not being raining. For example, if the lawn is wet because there is a water hose leaking onto the lawn. This claim is also supported by the idea that reasons are divisible. So common idea is that epistemic reasons can be defeated by other epistemic reasons. And this presupposes that such reason can be misleading and thus are fallible. This is true at least for rebutting defeaters. And note that this claim is not restricted to pro tanto reasons. It extends to all things considered sufficient decisive epistemic reasons. Philosophers think, many philosophers discussing epistemic reasons, think that it is possible to have a sufficient reason to believe something, but that thing may be false, as in the example I present. So the second claim is the altruism link. So many philosophers hold that there is a tight connection between norms and reason, particularly in very contemporary philosophy of normativity, a philosopher discussing both epistemic practical reason. So we can formulate the core idea of the altruism link in what I here put as a star. Agent A, pro tanto, or all things considered, ought to fi, if and only if there are all there are pro tanto or is considered a sufficient reason to fi. So philosophers tend to disagree about which side of this biconditional is ontologically or metaphysically prior. So many philosophers, in particular backpassers and philosophers trying to reduce all the normativity to all the different normative concepts to reason concept, hold that what you ought or may do believe, feel, is determined by what reason there are for you, for doing, believing, feeling, certain things. So if you ought to fight, that's because you have most or sufficient or decisive reason to fight. And if you might fight, that's because you lack most sufficient, you might not fight, sorry for error. That's because you lack most sufficient decisive reasons not to fight. Other philosophers take ought to be more fundamental. So the reasons there are for you to act, believe, feel are determined by what you ought or may do, believe, and feel. If you have most or decisive reason to fight, that's because you ought to fight and not vice versa. And here the because should be interpreted, has been interpreted in different way by philosophers. So Broom, for example, suggests that reasons are explanation of what you ought to do. Kearns and Starr and other philosophers suggest, like Thompson suggests, that what you have to do, but reasons are evidence of what you have to do. But in all those theories, we can save the claim Starr before. And Starr applies to both pro tanto and all considered reasons, or oaths or not, assuming that there are such things such as Protanto Oates, Protanto Schultz, Protanto Wright. So, for example, you Protanto should keep your promise if and only if you you have a Protanto reason to keep your promise. You all things considered ought to help your friend if and only if you have all things considered sufficient or conclusive reason to help your friend. Here there is a problem on whether we should add the sufficient reasons in such formulations when we consider all things considered formulations. And this is particularly important in the epistemic domain, where some philosophers think that there can be all things considered reason to believe something even if there are no sufficient reason to believe something. So it might be the case that all there is epistemic reason in a context support a certain proposition, but still all the this evidence is insufficient to make a rationale for the subject to believe the proposition. So some philosophers then think that there is still a difference between sufficiency and conclusivity of reasons. So things are complex here, but when I will use sufficient here, I will mean sufficient reason in the sense of sufficient to make it rational to believe the proposition. So note that in epistemology there is a substantial agreement that belief is governed by a unique norm or a unique fundamental norm from which other norms will be derived. So the idea is that this is the only source of epistemic normativity. And many philosophers try to explain epistemic normativity starting from this central norm. Pascal tried in several papers to discuss this, to make this derivation, to derive other epistemic norm from a truth norm. Other philosophers are Littlejohn, recently McHugh, Miller, Shah, Schoenwelleman, Wedgwood, Wittgenstein, Stiglitz, Petter. So, if this is true, if there is only one fundamental norm, epistemic norm, then what this fundamental norm requires or permits is all things considered. So we can drop the Protanto limitation to epistemic reasons. So as a subject as ought to believe at P or not to believe at P, if and only if there are sufficient reasons for the subject not to believe it. So the third claim is epistemic norm of activity, the idea that the condition required or permitted by the norm belief is factive. Many philosophers suggested different factive norms. Here is just some example. Many upholders of true norms suggest claims such as if a subject considers whether P, the subject should believe that P if and only if P is true. Some truth normers defend permissivist norms, such as Daniel Witting. Subject should believe P only if P. More and more people defend a knowledge norm, such as I should believe P only if subject knows P. Clayton Littlejohn also point defended a notion of justification, which is factive, and defend the view that one should believe P if and only if subject is justifiably believe P or is justified to believe P. And some philosophers in the US recently defended the view that the norm belief is being in a position to know. So a subject should believe P only if she is in a position to know P, where being in a position to know is a fact. So there are many arguments for the idea that epistemic norms are factive, different arguments for different norms. Here I will list just three that I find particularly compelling. One is the outer look of normative considerations in doxastic deliberation. So in order to decide whether to believe P, we look at how things are in the world, and in particular whether P is true, if we endorse the truth norm in particular. We don't look at our mind, except in cases in which the proposition is about our mind. So behind this consideration are many, many arguments in the literature. For example, the argument of Schoenwelleman on transparency and many other arguments, but this is the idea. So yeah, the idea is that our look in deliberating about normative matters is a good indication of what are the conditions that norms require us in that context. So, for example, if I have to deliberate whether to go to the party, I don't like to go to the party. So what kind of consideration I look at in order to decide whether to go to the party? I consider whether, for example, I promise to some friend to go to the party. And this is an indication that there is a norm that tells me to do what I promise the friend. And in the case of doxastic deliberation, the fact that we look at whether the proposition is true or false in order to decide whether to form a belief about a matter is an indication that the norm of belief is either true or knowledge, or anyway, it has an external factive condition. Another argument is first-person epistemic assessments and epistemic advice. We judge false beliefs or ones falling short of knowledge as epistemically defective and criticizable. And we suggest someone that has a false or get a belief to revise a belief. And this indicates that the truth, falsity, or falsity of a proposition matter to whether one ought to believe this proposition. Here we can find some very recent variants of this argument in Little John and in Williams. And another point is the intuitive dependence of non-factive assessment on factive ones. So many philosophers discussing epistemic norms reduce norms of rationality and evidence to norms of correctness, or they explain secondary assessments such as excusability assessment on primary knowledge-based assessment, for example, or, for example, reliability reduce assessment relative to the reliability of methods to the value of truth. So. At least this is a standard view in the literature. There are very few philosophers that deny this dependence of non-factive assessment on factive ones. Most philosophers also are endorsing factive views, but this seems to be quite a compelling idea. So here is a specific instance of the puzzle. Assume that something like a star is right, it's just a consequence of the out-reason link. According to a certain interpretation, at least, of this link. So an agent A ought to phi if and only if there are sufficient reason to phi. Now suppose that the norm belief is the truth norm. You ought to believe only the truth. So you ought not to believe falsities. So from the truth norm and the star, you can derive that there are never reason for you to believe P if P is false. And according to the truth norm, which is the only fundamental epistemic norm by assumption, one ought never to believe something false. So there is never sufficient reason to believe P if not P. But of course, this conclusion is the denial of reason fallibilism. It implies a form of reason fallibilism. So this is the puzzle. So here I will consider six possible solutions. How much time? Okay, 15 minutes. So the first three solutions are just denying one of the three claims that constitute the puzzle. So one is deny the out-reason link. So we can deny that what you ought or might do or believe is directly related or directly dependent, neither directly determined nor is directly determined by what reason you have. So we have to deny star, we have to deny that an agent A ought to phi if and only if there are sufficient reasons to phi. An example of this approach is one could interpret determining in the ought reason link in a weak sense in terms of indirect determination. So, for example, epistemic reasons will not be immediately entailed by what one ought to believe. They would mere fallible indications of what one ought to believe. And similar consideration would extend to other normative domains. What you ought to do wouldn't deter, what we have sufficient reason to do wouldn't just be determined, but what you we ought to do, but they would be mere indication of what we ought to do. A consequence of this approach is would be a subordinate role of epistemic reasons in epistemic normativity and in normativity more in general, if you extend this to other domains. The cost of denying the out-reason link, taking this part, is that this would involve the rejection of many standard views in the literature. This is not supposed to be an ad hominem argument, but the point is that many of those views are motivated by independent arguments. For example, the arguments for backpassing accounts support the reduction of oaths to reasons in the way I specified before. And different philosophers provide different arguments, but it's quite implausible that all those arguments are completely incorrect, both on the side of those that want to reduce reasons to oaths and oaths to reasons. Another reason why it's bad to deny the oath-reason link is constituted by analogies with the practical domain, which suggests that this is not an appealing option. So consider fallible indications about what we ought to do according to the norm, keep your promises. Are these indications reasons to act? If I seem to remember that I promised to five, and thus I have an indication of what I should do, does this indication constitute a reason to do what I take to have a promise? This seems to be implausible, because if you think we promise to fight, but we actually promise not to fight, it seems that we shouldn't conclude that we have only reason to fight and not reason to fight. If Hitler sees something good in killing innocent people, does Hitler have reason to kill them, given that his seemings constitute indications that he should kill people? So this is a reason to deny the oath-reason link. Another problem with the oath-reason link is that this link would likely be merely instrumental if we reduce reasons to mere indication of what we ought to do. So if reasons are fallible indication of what we ought to do, believe, feel, why should we do, believe, feel, or whatever else, what we have reason to do, believe, or feel? And an obvious and plausible answer at this point is that presumably this is because reasons constitute reliable or fallible means to satisfy what we ought to do. But then the normativity of reasons, including epistemic reasons, would depend on fallible instrumental means and considerations. Now, many challenge the claim that we are normatively required to take reliable means to ends, goals, values, and those. There are many arguments in the church, such as bootstrapping argument in Cologne, arguments in Danzig, and also other arguments in the specific epistemic domain. But even if you accept that instrumental considerations can be normative, the normativity of reasons would not be genuine epistemic normativity, but dependent on principles of rational standard rationality, such as the general transmission principle, wide scope requirement, and so on. So to be a problem for reasons to believe, to preserve their genuine epistemic nature in such a type of experiment. So the second possibility is to deny epistemic non-factivity. We can choose some non-factive norms, such as the subject ought to believe a P if and only if the subject's cognitive system reliably indicates that P, or if the subject's other internal mental states support P, something like an irrationality or evidential norm. And the normal belief would imply or be determined by fallible epistemic reasons. And the problem with this view are exactly the advantages of epistemic non-factivity that I mentioned before. So it's difficult to explain the data supporting factive norms, the outer look of normative consideration to cast deliberation, first-person epistemic assessment, advice, and intuitive dependence on non-factive assessment of factive ones. What if we deny reason fallibilism? Well, so why if we endorse reason infallibilism? The problem is that this is at odds with the common sense notion of reason to believe. Consider the following claim. Tom had all reason to believe that P, but in fact he was wrong. Intuitively, this sentence doesn't sound like a Murean-like assertion, as it should sound if reasons were infallible in this sense. Intuitively, this sentence doesn't sound odd, or sounds surely less odd than Tom knew that P, but in fact he was wrong. So if we deny reason fallibilism, we must adopt some quite radical error theory about our ordinary conception of epistemic reasons or our use of reasons expression. Furthermore, intuitively, there are contributory elements in epistemic normativity, which are considerations to which we attribute normative significance and which can conflict and be weighed against each other. For example, that the knife is in the room of Jack is weighed against the fact that Bill says that at 11 p.m. Jack was playing poker with him, when we have to deliberate whether to believe that Jack is the murderer. So reason seems to be the best candidate to play this role of contributory elements. What else could do the job? And then if we assume that epistemic reasons don't play this job, it seems clear that practical reasons play this job in the practical domain. So we should introduce a completely different account of epistemic and practical reasons. The problem is that contributory reasons are fallible reasons. This is incompatible with reasons infallibilism. So here is the fourth approach, which saves the three claims considered above. The idea is that there are many epistemic norms, some requiring fallible conditions, determining or being determined by fallible reasons, and other infallible conditions. So factive epistemic norms would determine infallible epistemic reasons. Fallible epistemic norms would determine fallible reasons. For example, a truth norm and an evidence norm would do the job. The problem is that, first of all, this view introduces a dilemma. If epistemic norms are either epistemic norms are reciprocally dependent or they are not, if epistemic norms are independent each other, then we have potential possible epistemic conflicts between norms. So, for example, if evidence is the non-factive norm and truth is the factive norm, in case in which we have evidence that supports P, but we don't believe, but P is false, or we don't know that P, the fallible norm would give us reason to believe that P, and the infallible one would give us reason not to believe that P. Then the question is, what should we believe in these cases? Are there cases in which we weight those two types of considerations once against each other, as in the practical cases in which we have different reasons? Are there genuine conflict between two independent, equally fundamental and reducible epistemic norms issuing contradictory demands? How to resolve such conflicts? And why do we systematically fail to experience such type of conflict between fallible and infallible reasons? And second problem is that intuitively the two norms are not independent and equally fundamental. Intuitively, if we should believe what is reliable or what we take to be likely, this is because it has more chances of being true and not vice versa. And this could be repeated choosing different norms different from truth and evidence. If on the contrary we take the other on the dilemma, then on the we have this a similar problem to the one I considered before when I considered the hypothesis of taking reasons are mere indication what we ought to do. And the problem is again, what kind of dependence? And the plausible answer to this question, the most plausible answer, or probably the only plausible answer, is that this relation should be teleological, maybe instrumental. But teleology depends, teleologically dependent norms either are not normative at all, for the reason I considered before, in the sense that they do not generate reasons, or they are partially derived from other non-epistemic normative standards, such as means-end instrumental requirements, transmission principle, rationality requirements, and therefore they are not genuinely epistemic reasons. Furthermore, if reasons provided by the fundamental norm are systematically vaguer than those provided by derivative norms, because they are infallible and the other reasons are not, there are sufficient reasons to respect derivative norms only to the extent that and when they are conducive to the satisfaction of the fundamental norm. In all other cases, they are defeated. So a similar argument has been used by Danzi against the idea of subjective and objective ought in the practical domain, objective and subjective reasons. Subjective reasons will play a very reduced role if objective reasons are always vaguer than the subjective reasons, and would always win when they are confronted in the same context. Another problem, the most astounding problem from this approach is that this approach doesn't address the real problem. The issue here is not how to explain fallible epistemic reasons, does it reduce effective norms, but how to make sense of infallible epistemic reasons. And this distinction doesn't, this view doesn't make any sense. So, given that I only 5 minutes, I will be very fast on the other two, on the next possibility. The next idea is that belief is ambiguous. Ambiguous between a partial belief sense and the outer belief sense. Many philosophers argue for an ambiguity of a belief. For example, belief in sentences like "I don't believe that my lottery ticket is the winner," or "I believe that Clinton will win the present elections," are uses of belief as a conjecture, partial belief, or thought, where claims such as "I am in Paris" express an outer belief of me. An outer belief is a belief is belief as taking to be the case. It involves what some philosopher called doxastic closure, such as glancing and nagging, the question whether P is closed for me when I have an outer belief at P. So the idea here is not to have many epistemic norms of belief, but to have different norms for different doxastic attitudes. A norm for partial belief, which determines fallible norms, fallible reasons, the belief. A norm such as subject should believe at P only if the subject has a possibly fallible indication that P is the case. And the effective norm for outer belief, determining infallible reasons. So this view has some advantages. Here I have not, for example, it explained the disagreement in the literature on the notion of belief on cases such as lottery cases. And he has several advantages on which I cannot now deal. But there are problems with this approach, because the first problem is that while we are sensitive to the belief ambiguity, we tend to be insensitive to a corresponding ambiguity in the notion of epistemic reasons. So again, the account need an error theory to explain this lack of sensitivity to the ambiguity of the notion of epistemic reasons. Furthermore, intuitively, not only there are the feasible and fallible reasons not to partially believe, but also there are the feasible and fallible reasons not to outer belief. For example, we tend to consider reliable and overwhelming but misleading evidence as a reason to outer belief. However, according to the present proposal, this evidence cannot be a reason to outer belief. So consider this following example. Didn't read on a newspaper that Paris Saint-Germain won 2-1. The newspaper is usually very reliable. By reading on the same newspaper, Jim acquired knowledge about many other facts. However, this time the newspaper includes an error, Paris Saint-Germain lost 2-1. So according to this account, the newspaper reported cannot constitute a reason to outright believe that Paris Saint-Germain won. This seems to be quite counterintuitive. The weird thing of this, the weird consequence of assuming this is that in the good cases, in the case in which we form knowledge from reading on the newspapers, we have reason to outright belief. But in the case in which the evidence is misleading, we have only reason to form a partial belief. So. We are even not sensitive to the norm we have to follow in each context, and this is quite odd. Okay, here is another problem with this view, but so I pass to the last possible approach. This approach consists in making the factive from the fallible, as I call it. So the idea is that epistemic reasons are considerations that are individually fallible, but together they support a factive condition required by the norm belief. So assume that epistemic reasons are more primitive than norms and determine what you ought to believe, not vice versa. So take a form of maybe particularism about reason. And second, that epistemic reasons are individually fallible. They provide mere fallible support. By their result, the result of their weight, total weight, is always effective, effective now. So they always determine, for example, a permission to believe P on leaf B. So, for example, a case is one in which the norm is truth. Epistemic reasons whether to believe P are the set of all truths relevant to whether P, including necessarily either P itself or facts entailing P. So this proposal has the consequence that the epistemic reasons that are for us to believe something in a context are almost always facts that we don't know, and sometimes facts that are unknowable to us. Because in order to make from the infallible specific consideration, an infallible result, we need to take in consideration at least some reasons which is infallible, such as the proposition itself or the truth itself or some fact entailing this. So the problem with this view is that there are several problems. One is that reasons to believe a proposition include the very proposition support or propositions entailing it. This is necessary to determine effective norm from fallible considerations. And this is considered seriously problematic and intuitive by many philosophers. Problematic for the role of reasons in deliberation. It's problematic because it seems incorrect to say that my reason to believe that P is P itself, and for many other reasons like this. Second problem is that epistemic reasons can include, and very often include, facts that the subject cannot know. And those facts are necessarily part of our epistemic reasons in order to determine effective conclusion, but sometimes we cannot access those facts. So the point is that when we have just a limited number of epistemic reasons, fallible epistemic reasons, we cannot determine a factive norm without taking on board as epistemic reasons infallible epistemic facts that entail the proposition. And in doing this, we have to take a proposition such as the very same truth value of the proposition we are considering, or facts that entail this proposition. And finally, this approach has put important restriction on the old reason link, because reasons must come first, determine what one ought to believe, so one has to accept some form of particularism about reasons, so has to weaken the old reason link in one of the two directions of explanation. Epistemic reasons can only determine what one ought all things considered to believe. They cannot determine what you ought pertanto believe. So the pertanto ought disappears in this view. Those are the main problems. So here is the conclusion, which is an aporetic conclusion, as at the beginning. In this talk, I introduce a philosophical puzzle about epistemic reasons. The puzzle is due to an apparent tension between three claims independently defended by philosophers. I considered and critically assessed six possible solutions to this puzzle, and I argue that this approach are all affected by some problems. Thanks for your attention and for your attention.